Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, and welcome to Late Night Lit. This month's episode will be a little bit different. First, you'll hear a conversation I had with the fantastic author Patricia Engel that we recorded for South by Southwest earlier this month. Then, we have a brand new interview I did with Chad Sanders, the dynamic author of the new book, Black Magic, What Black Leaders Learned from Trauma and Triumph. So, here we go.
Hello, South by Southwest. I'm Seth Meyers, host of Late Night on NBC. Last summer, we launched a special podcast series we call Late Night Lit, which is devoted to shining a light on the world of books and authors. In this special South by Southwest edition of Late Night Lit, our own Sarah Jenks Daly will lead a conversation with novelist Patricia Engel, whose book Infinite Country is available now. Without further ado, take it away, Sarah.
Thanks, Seth, and hi, South by Southwest. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, a supervising producer at Late Night with Seth Meyers. As Seth mentioned, we launched our book-centric podcast, Late Night Lit, last summer, and we are thrilled to bring this special edition to South by Southwest. Today, I'll have a conversation with Patricia Engel, award-winning novelist of Infinite Country, which is available now. Hi, Patricia. Welcome, and thank you for doing this.
Hi, Sarah. I'm so happy to be with you today.
I'm realizing I'm much more comfortable as a disembodied podcasting voice, so you'll have to bear with me a little bit here.
Of course.
Congratulations on the novel. I know it's your fourth book.
It is my fourth. It's hard to believe.
It must have been much different to do press for this book than it has for the last three books that you've written.
It's different. Releasing a book in a pandemic is definitely something I never thought that I would be doing. But we've been at this for a year already, so I've gotten a chance to see how these things are happening with virtual book tours and not being able to get into bookstores or festivals like we normally do. But it's still been really fun. We've still been able to connect with readers and bring the book to people. So I'm really enjoying seeing the creative possibilities despite the limitations.
Seth has talked on the show to a number of authors during this last year, and we've talked about how the actual pursuit of writing, because writers are so used to this solitary pursuit, the actual job of writing hasn't changed that much. It's much more the putting it out there in the world and what happens once you publish the book and then have to talk about it.
Yes, writing is the same. It's you just show up to your computer, to your notebook day after day, and there's not really anybody there who will say, wow, you did good today. It was a really good, productive day. It's something that you have to keep yourself motivated at day by day, month by month, year after year. So that has remained the same. But here we are with the publishing process that this is something totally new.
Yeah, I bet. The book is so wonderful. It touches upon issues and themes such as immigration, love, relationships between family units, racism, deportation. But I think at the core, which is most important, is that it's a story about a family unit, at least it seemed to me, about a family unit that is separated and fractured and trying to find its way back to itself. It spans over many decades, and so I wondered, how did you set up this story? How did it form for you? Did it begin with one specific character?
Well, I knew that I wanted to tell the story of a family, and I wanted to inhabit all the family members. So there's the two parents and the three children, and they're having a collective experience as a family in the process of emigrating, but they're also each having their own individual experience because they occupy very different spaces on this spectrum of migratory statuses that are assigned depending on where they were born or when or how they arrived to the United States or where they're living now. So I wanted to show how people can be sharing one experience, but having a very different one on the inside.
The novel also definitely moves from, at the beginning, you know, mountainous area of Colombia to Bogota to Texas to New Jersey. I wondered why, what was most important to you in the structure of trying to make sure that your readers were really immersed in each different setting?
It's so much a story about our connections to our homelands, the places and the people and the communities that make us. So the only way to show that is to really show how specific each place is. This is a family with roots in Colombia, in Bogota specifically, the capital, which happens to be my mother's hometown. And it's a place that I know pretty well. I have a lot of family there. But it's so unique, the Andean topography, the landscapes, the views. That's really something that you cannot understand unless you go there. And of course, as a writer, my goal is to do the next best thing, is to take you there with the words and the images. But it's really important to understand how this family is no longer part of their homeland, and they're making a life in a new country. But that homeland, the connections to the land and the people and even the nature, remains with them. And that's something that I've gotten more interested in as I've gotten older, how our origins, our points of origin, are a part of us in ways that are even deeper than we understand.
When you said you know the city quite well, did you do any type of research in going back? Because you are so specific with details of from the way that a house looks to the way that a city is set up. Were there things that you felt like you needed to revisit when you were writing this?
Yeah, as a writer, my whole life is really an exercise of research. I'm always looking at things closely and internalizing things and trying to find meaning and beauty in pretty much everything all the time. So that's one part of it. But of course, in translating that into a reading experience, there's the additional research. Of course, what I want is the people who know those places even better than me to feel like I got it right, that I wasn't superficial or sloppy or careless in my renderings, out of respect for them. And also because when I read things that I can feel like are sloppy and superficial renderings, it really bugs me as a reader.
Have you heard from any of those people? Did you share this with them in early stages?
Well, the first people to read this book were in my family. And, you know, they were all pleased. And the book just launched yesterday. But the people who have read it already, among them a lot of Colombians, have reached out to me, and also people in different immigrant families who came from different places but had similar experiences. And they say, wow, you know, I feel like this is our story too.
That's wonderful. That must be the highest praise you can get.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are many instances in the story where we see how actual government policies that were put in place impact these characters' lives, albeit fictional characters. You talked before about being a researcher for life as a writer. Did you do any research into public policy, past government policies, or other types of, like immersing yourself in a library just to find out how exactly these types of policies affected people who immigrated here?
Yeah, of course. I would be an irresponsible writer if I didn't. But the fact is, I'm the daughter of Colombian immigrants. It's I grew up in a community of people whose lives were touched and challenged, very similarly to the characters in Infinite Country. I know these stories well. I know the people who I love most, who are dearest to me, my closest friends and most beloveds, are often challenged similarly. So there's a lot that I knew just from my life and my world as the daughter of immigrants. But I am a responsible writer, and I have to do my own verifying and fact checking and making sure that I get those details right.
You mentioned you were born to Colombian parents. There's so much in the novel that addresses and touches upon the lives of immigrants and even those who are born in this country, but perhaps are looked at as immigrants because of their parents. And there's a lot, I think, you do such a wonderful job of showing how people can be grouped into a group and thought of as just a stereotype. And I wondered, when writing from all these different perspectives, was a part of that due to the fact that you really wanted to show, amplify maybe that there isn't just one story that encompasses a group of people, that there are so many different ways that one event can impact different people?
Yeah, I grew up in the 1980s and 90s, and you'll recall that was a time of a lot of stereotypes of Colombians. The only representations that were of Colombians were, of course, for drug trafficking and criminal behavior. The Colombians that I knew were wonderful, warm, loving, hardworking people. They were my heroes, people I most admired. So, of course, my writing is an effort to write against that. And also to acknowledge that stereotypes exist because they serve special interests, right? So I'm always countering that and challenging that in my work. And the idea that there is a singular immigrant experience is also a myth and a fallacy. The fact is that almost everybody in this country came to the United States because somebody in their ancestry took that step, was the breakaway person who broke and fractured, severed the family tree, the connection between the homeland and this country. A lot of people have been here so long that they've forgotten that. They've disassociated from that connection. But in a lot of ways, the story of the family in Infinite Country is everybody's story in this country.
There's also a reverence and acknowledgement in the book for ancestry and culture and stories that have been passed down. You've said that in many ways you were raised by stories and storytellers. So I was wondering if any of those specific stories were nods to your own personal history or stories that you had heard as a kid.
There's a lot of what people call mythology or ancestral knowledge or traditional history in the novel. And some of that I did grow up with. My mother's from Bogota, and a lot of it is specific to the region of what is now Bogota, which was the land that was inhabited by the Muisca civilization. So some stories I knew from early on in my life, and others were told to me and where I picked up from travels. And because I'm just a curious person, one thing leads to another. Because some stories are specific to different regions. But there are a lot of moments in the novel that some people might think, wow, that could never happen. It's just, you know, some fantastical tale that are true, that actually happened. And those kinds of seemingly outside reality moments are actually very Colombian.
That's so funny. Are there any in particular that you can... There's one I'm thinking of, but I was wondering if... Are there any in particular that
Which one are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of one with the snake and the eyes, where it tells a story about this. The father can't recognize the daughter because the snake has...
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a bit of a folklore. Oh, yeah. And that one always seemed to me like a very sad story. But I was thinking of a different one, which is the story of there's a sort of spiritual kind of exorcism that takes place in the novel, where it's believed that bad spirits or bad energies are in a household. So this kind of impromptu effort to get rid of those spirits occurs. And that's true. That was a true occurrence lived by one of my relatives.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. There's a passage that I would love if you would be willing to read that sort of speaks to what we were just talking about in the book on page 104.
Sure. Elena remembered a story Perla told her in the months before she and Mauro left Colombia. They were sweeping in the lavanderia as they did every evening after locking up. Elena worried about leaving her mother alone. The workers they hired were undependable, rarely lasting more than a few weeks. Perla told her about a mother and daughter who lived alone together, like they had before Elena met Mauro. The mother and daughter were very close, loved each other very much, and had no family but each other. One day they were walking together on the road when they were confronted by a wicked man who macheted them both to death. The daughter had lived a pure life, so she went straight to heaven, but the mother had lived a longer, more complicated life, so she waited in limbo, looking up to heaven, and one day spotted her daughter in all her eternal glory. She called for her daughter to lower her hair so she could climb it and join her in the upper world. The daughter dropped her braids, her mother climbed, and the two were overjoyed at being reunited. The mother thought her daughter had saved her from languishing in the void, Perla had said. She didn't know she'd already been purified, that her daughter was only waiting until it was her mother's turn to be called home.
I love that so much.
Thank you.
When you were incorporating these stories, I wondered how you went about it just to put the book together, because you do put them in different places over the course of the book, and I was just wondering what that process was like in terms of setting it all up.
The way that I thought about it is that this is really a family chronicle, and you find out at a certain point in the book that this is the family story that's being assembled by one of the children, the oldest daughter. I don't think I'm giving anything away in saying that. And I wanted it to feel as if she was right in the room with you, the way that people tell their stories, you know, and there's an urgency. I've got to tell you something. When you have one of those unforgettable conversations with somebody you've just met, and you walk away and you feel like you know them in a really, you know, meaningful way. But the way that people tell stories is not chronological. And very often it's pulling apart. It's saying, I'm going to tell you this, but first I have to tell you this. And this happened, but that only makes sense if I also tell you about something else that means something to these people. So that's really how life happens, and that's how storytelling happens. And I wanted the novel to replicate that.
That's a really thoughtful answer. I love that. I know you've written books that have been translated into many languages, and you speak Spanish and English. And I wondered, when you're writing, do you ever have the experience where you feel like you can say something in English, but it doesn't translate into Spanish, or words fail you in that way, or vice versa, from Spanish to English? Does that happen when you're writing ever?
All the time. It happens to me when I'm not writing, when I'm just talking. It happens all the time because language, we of course invented it. It's not like blood. It's not like bones. We had to create it. So of course it falls short of our human needs. And there are so many human experiences that we have not yet found the words for. But what is always fascinating to me is that some languages have gotten closer to describing certain human experiences. There's a lot of human experiences that can be described in a closer way in Spanish, for example, than in English. You know, I'll give you an example. There's a word in Spanish called añoranza, which is this very deep longing for something that was, that can no longer be. You know, it could be a place, your homeland, or just something that already happened. And just look at how many words I had to use in English to say what that one word says.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Do you find that it happens much more often when you're writing or just in your day-to-day life?
Both. I often, you know, will reach into Spanish to express something that I need to. I live in Miami where everybody does this.
That's a good place to live for that problem, I guess, then. Mm-hmm. I'd love to know about your own writing process. Is there a particular time of day that you like to write? Do you have to be in a quiet area? Do you play music? What does it look like when you sit down and start writing?
I try not to be too picky about having rituals, because then if you don't have them, you panic. I do have preferences, though. So I would say on a perfect writing day, I would start in the morning because I prefer natural light. I don't really like to write by lamplight or at night. I prefer to read at night. So I'll write by daylight. I keep a whole bunch of notebooks where I've done all my pre-writing, daydreaming, idea sketching nearby, and I'll write on the computer for a couple of hours in silence. I don't write with music or anything like that playing. And yeah, that to me would be a perfect writing day.
This book is such a spectacular novel, and I really enjoyed it so much. I would highly recommend it to everybody. I thought it was just like a very well-written story that I really loved. And I'm wondering if you have any books that you've recently read and loved that you'd like to share with whoever is watching or listening.
Yeah, I've read a bunch of great books lately, and some that are just coming out right now. My book was published yesterday, and another book that was published yesterday was What's Mine and Yours by Naima Coster, and I recommend it to everybody. Also, The Committed by Viet Thanh Nguyen. There's a book that I read an early copy of coming out this summer, The President and the Frog by Carolina de Robertis. And I'm really excited to read Brandon Hobson's new one, The Removed. And another book that came out a few months ago that I adored was A Burning by Megha Majumdar.
I just read Brandon Hobson's book. It's fantastic. I recommend that one very much, too. It was such a delight to speak to you. Thank you so much for chatting with us today. And Infinite Country is available now wherever books are sold, but please support your local and independent bookstores. Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
We'll be right back with Chad Sanders.
Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend, Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired-looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
Chad Sanders is a writer, a creator, an entrepreneur, an author, and in his new book, Black Magic, What Black Leaders Learned from Trauma and Triumph, Chad writes openly and honestly about his own personal experience as a young Black man in a very white Silicon Valley. He also shares the stories he collected from hundreds of hours of interviews he did with innovative and thoughtful Black leaders. They dive into conversations about identity, value, authenticity, and faith. Now, here's my conversation with Chad. Chad, hello. Welcome to Late Night Lit. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Congratulations on this book. It is fantastic. I really enjoyed reading it so much. And I'd love to start with some background on what inspired you to write it. The introduction, I think, delves into this in detail and sort of sets up the book, but I was hoping you could share a little bit about that with our listeners.
Yeah, the inspiration was, this was the book that I needed. I was a mid-20s, let's say 25-ish, junior executive, I guess is what I would call myself. That's like to flatter myself, though. I was someone working in the lower rungs of Google and then at a tech startup. And I was feeling a little flattened by what seemed to be the culture of corporations in America, and I think in most of the world, where frankly, white men sit at the top in the board seats, in the chief operating and chief executive officer roles, in the majority shareholder seats. And while there is some effort and some small amount of diversity sort of scattered in beneath them, most of the culture of these big corporations feels like sort of an ode to and a celebration of whiteness. And I'm Black, and I didn't feel like I was going to be able to achieve my dream of sitting in one of those seats at the top as a Black person because of what I saw. So I wanted to go interview Black people who had navigated that labyrinth and found their way either to the top or to something else that was bigger for them or bigger to them. And so that's what I did. That was the impetus for the book, and that was what I did.
You mentioned the interview. So not only is this book about your own personal story, and you do a really nice job of weaving in stories from your childhood and your professional life, reflections on what you've learned, but you also embarked upon conducting these interviews with other Black creatives, professionals who share their experiences. I wanted to know, how did you go about planning the actual setup of that? And what was the most challenging part of ultimately putting that all together to make a book?
So when I took the concept out with my agent, you know, first we had to sell a book. So I made a list of who I thought would be the most interesting, the most honest, and probably the most informed Black people across industries that I could think of that I could possibly reach. And my reach was not tremendous at that point. That was 4 years ago. I had just embarked on my journey into a new industry, which was Hollywood. I didn't have a giant network, but you know, I was aspirational. I said, hey, I want to see if I can get Kanye to talk about this. I want to see if I can get, you know, Spike Lee to talk about this. I want to see if I can get, I don't know, the biggest Black hedge fund runner or whoever. I just wanted to get everybody big that I could think of. I wanted to get Oprah. And then when I actually set out to conduct the interviews, what I found early on, and I did get some pretty amazing access. You know, there I did 200 interviews for this book. Only 15 of them are in there. And what I found was that it was the people who didn't have big public profiles. It was the people who didn't have audiences to answer to. It was people who were working in technology, venture capital firms, pastors, some media executives, but not particularly front-facing media executives. It was those were the people who were really willing to get into the nitty-gritty. And honestly, those were the people who weren't scared to offend white people. And they gave the really grave and honest stories. And those are the ones that went in the book.
That's what I wanted to ask, because there's a caveat in the book that you share about individuals who didn't want to share their stories. You don't have to name names right now, but were there any people that you were maybe sort of surprised said yes that you didn't think would, or that you alternately were hoping to include but didn't get to?
I would say more of the latter, and I wouldn't say that I was surprised. You know, a lot of these interviews happened riding around with someone and their security guard in Los Angeles, you know, in the car with me with my phone out just recording. Mm-hmm. Some of them happened, you know, in people's backyards, over the phone. You know, these interviews, I had to do them. It was sort of guerrilla warfare, so to speak. I had to just like get them however I could. And, you know, when you catch somebody in the flow and you're just going back and forth sharing experiences before a PR rep or a manager has gotten a chance to listen to the recording, they're going to say a lot of, you know, they're going to tell you about that first time that they were called an or the first time that they walked in on their manager saying something racist to one of his subordinates, thinking that they weren't listening. You know, they're going to tell you that stuff. But once you get it on a mic, once you get it on record, you know, I wasn't a professional journalist going into that. I didn't have sort of the leverage and the girth to, you know, bully people around and tell them like, well, I already have it on record, so it's going in the book. You know, these were relationships that I needed. So those people would circle back without naming them. As you said, I didn't have to. Those people would circle back with their PR reps or whoever, and they'd say, hey, that thing, that interview, like, you're going to have to kill it because that's going to be bad for our public image or whatever. But the counter to that is in the book, you know, I don't know, Letitia Thomas, Jason Crane, Ed Bailey, Brian Shields. These are not household names, but they're household names, I would say, in the upper echelons of their independent industries. And, you know, Shelley Stewart's partner at McKinsey, like, those are people who have stuff to lose if somebody thinks this is offensive or if somebody thinks they're lying or making it up. And they shared it anyway, because I think they care that much about having the truth in a book.
I know you mentioned 200 interviews. Was there anything that came up again and again that you weren't expecting to keep hearing?
People talked a lot about faith. These are intellectuals, you know, these are highly degreed, you know, there are scientists from MIT and MBAs from Stanford and Harvard. And, you know, these are people, a lot of these people, honestly, they come from the hood. They come from the neighborhood. Like, it's not like they grew up in houses that were so highly degreed or whatever, but they have escalated the sort of highbrow environment. And I was surprised to learn from such intellectuals that so much of their journey is fueled by faith and belief, both in God and in themselves. And a lot of them speak to how important it was as a turning point in their journeys when they stopped making decisions based on what was on a spreadsheet or what their, you know, favorite advisor was telling them, and started getting back into their bodies and making decisions based on repetitions, intuition, and faith. And I would say that some of the trauma of living while Black in this country is that you can get detached from feeling, because so many of the feelings that are rushing into your body on a regular daily basis are negative. They're fear, they're anger, they're violence. And you can start living in your head as a coping device. But these people had to undo that detachment to really catapult in their careers.
Mm-hmm. Early in the book, you address your reader directly about navigating trauma and experiencing racism and what the book holds. You write, "If your response to this premise is to say, 'Well, I'm not Black, but I've experienced trauma, what about me?' Keep reading. You too possess a set of special skills. For anyone who has never endured hardship, congratulations. Find a seat in the back and be quiet. And for all others, welcome." How often do you hear from those people who maybe should be listening, but who are so desperate to weigh in?
Well, that is the thing. I was just reading a tweet. Somebody tweeted at me something about code switching. In the book, you know, I suggest that code switching is a pain and a nuisance to many Black people, but it can also be a gift. It teaches you empathy. It teaches you to learn how to speak someone else's language, which can be fantastic if you ever get a chance to leverage that. And of course, like, there's always "well, actually" guy on Twitter or in my comments or whatever, and sometimes in my text messages, who says, "Well, actually, you know, white people invented code switching because we were the first people who learned how to manage people of other races in this country in capitalism," blah, blah, blah. Like, some bullshit like that, right? So, excuse me, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse, but
that's okay. So
to your question, I don't think anybody, I mean, that is sort of the nature of what I'm trying to say in that statement. Like, no one has said, "I haven't endured trauma," because, I mean, being born is traumatic. So I don't think there's anybody who hasn't endured trauma. All I'm trying to say is that the nature of this book, the title of this book, is born of the fact that we push our trauma down, we hide it, we throw it in a closet and close the door because we don't want to keep reliving those experiences over and over and over again because they hurt. If we can open that closet door and dust off some of those experiences and examine them and see what happened there and what we learned and adapted from it, I think we, not just as Black people, but as anyone who's had trauma that we've shoved in the closet, we can use that stuff and we can put it back in the closet if that's where it needs to go after we use it. That's the nature of what I'm saying.
In the book, you talk about growing up in a house where you would all share what you were learning and reading about at the dinner table. Is that something that has always stayed with you and inspired you? Because over this last year, which has been a lot, I know many of us have felt emotionally challenged and additionally creatively challenged. Was finding inspiration and creativity difficult for you?
It wasn't for me. I wrote this book. It took 4 years from the time we sold it to Simon & Schuster as our partners to the time it came out. So I was writing on and off on this book for, you know, let's call it 3.5 years. Last summer, the summer of George Floyd, if we can just call it that for a second, was like a lightning bolt of creativity. I was sad and angry, and I think a lot of people were, and confused and also exhausted. And that cocktail of emotions really helped me find the last leg of writing this book and also of editing this book. And I want to talk about that. So during that summer, I, like many Black people, was inundated with reach outs and texts from our white friends saying that, you know, they were thinking of us, smiley face emoji, heart emoji, you know, not really knowing what to do in support of what was going on, which I can understand. But it was a little bit annoying. It did feel like it put the onus on us to sort of manage those emotions and all that inbound. And I wrote a piece for the New York Times about it. And the piece did very well. I mean, it was shared very broadly. And I think a lot of people felt it. And it was very terse and it was very honest. And it was a little bit smirking, I guess. And it was asking our allies or imploring them to take actions of real sacrifice to help with what was going on. Send money to a viable cause. Reach out to relatives who stand on the other side of these matters and tell them that you're not coming home for the holidays. And, you know, it was listing bit by bit, here are some real ways to help, not with freaking emojis. You know, seeing the response to that very terse message made me go back to the book to make sure that the book was written with that level of just spare honesty. And it made me take out anything that was hedging or anything that was meant to soften the message so that white people wouldn't be mad at me. And I think that is like when you talk about creativity, I mean, the creativity comes constantly and it comes like in a flow, in a fire hose. The thing that can sometimes stop it or bottleneck it is, am I going to, quote unquote, get in trouble for what I have to say that's honest? Are the white people in my life going to look at me differently or abandon me? And are the white partners that I have who work at my publisher, work at the studios I work with, work at the networks I work with, are they going to decide, you know, no more of this guy and put the kibosh? And I think last summer just pushed me to say, forget about that and just do it anyway.
Yeah, well, I think that speaks to the whole theme of the book, too, because those were the types of people that you were able to get those stories out of and hear from and get their perspective on things. And it seems like it all sort of came full circle in that way.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, that is, and I need to digest the pill of the book over and over and over again. It's so tempting to sort of get to the next, you know, if you're in an office, it's get to the next promotion, get to the next level, get to the next floor. If you're me, it's okay. 4 years ago, I was, you know, writing scripts for $1,000 for celebrities who ended up never paying me. And then it was, all right, you've sold your first show. And then it was, but you sold it to a Black network. Then it's like, all right, you've sold your first show to a white network. And it's like, there can be this scary and false idea that you're like escalating a mountain of some kind. And each echelon that you get to, you look around and you're like, well, maybe I should just like keep my mouth shut now because I'm here and these white people are giving me money and they're listening to me. Maybe I shouldn't upset them. And that screws it up for everybody. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask lastly, are there any books that you would like to recommend to our listeners that you've either recently read or you love?
Yes. One book that I read and reread is called On Writing by Stephen King. That's the book for people if you want to be a writer or if you are a writer, I would say. The first half is really about his life and the second half is about like the mechanics of writing. And I just think it's really great. And the second book I would suggest, if you can give me 10 seconds to look.
Sure.
As promised.
We can just point out to our listeners that you have a pretty extensive bookshelf behind you that you're combing through.
Oh, thank you. Here's one. It's called Alicia Afterimage. It is by Lulu Delacre. It is a book that was written in the mid-2000s, the first decade of the 2000s, shortly after my best friend died in a car accident. Her mother, who is a very talented writer and illustrator, wrote an account of her life through the eyes of her best friends from our high school that is very beautiful with her illustrations and very poetic in the way that teenagers talk about a dead friend.
Oh, wow. I'll have to check that out. Chad, it was so nice to speak to you. Thank you so much. And I also just want to thank your friend, late night staffer, field producer Amanda Cowper, for the introduction as well.
Yeah, me too. I hope that makes it onto the recording. Thank you, Amanda.
It will.
And thank you. Thanks, y'all.
This has been Late Night Lit. My thanks to Seth Meyers, Mike Shoemaker, Patricia Engel, Chad Sanders, Kat Spillane, Matt Ryman, Lauren Roseman, Lauren Minesovit, Jay Johnson, and Ross Leupold. Our theme music was written and performed by the HE Band. For Late Night with Seth Meyers, I'm Sarah Jinks Daly. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.